Dr. Ray Kirkhove is an historian from Queensland, a great expert in Indigenous history, and last year at the Australian Historical Association conference he gave a paper on Indigenous warfare in Queensland in the 19th century, and that has now led to him sitting in our Brisbane studio. Thanks, Ray.
Hi.
What's your view of Blaney's perspective that a lot of Australian historians have a romanticised view of Aborigines living in harmony with the environment and each other?
Yeah, I don't think we do racial politics much help, you know, by romanticising anything. But on the other hand, there's a natural diversity that happens. It happens with species and it happens with cultures too, you know, that we do often go our own ways on things. And I think, you know, what's seen as all this sort of harmony with nature is more the fact that Aboriginal people from all the communities I've dealt with, they were looking at another way of dealing with things. And in their case, they had an experience of, well, how do we deal with our environment? And they came up with some radical, I would call it a science of that, which we're still unravelling. And I would say out of all the world's cultures, it's the one where we've learned the most about a sort of ecological awareness.
What about their military skills? Let's look at this.
Yeah.
Blaney argues that they were very weak because there was so little evidence of intertribal cooperation. Doesn't your research go somewhere to contradicting that, Ray?
Yes, yes. I think, you know, I've been looking at I've been doing this for decades, but I'm looking at it again a lot lately. I think it's often the sources need to be reevaluated. There is actually, when you actually look at the primary stuff, when people are first reporting it, they're actually talking about a lot of cooperation between groups in mounting attacks on the settlers. They're not saying, oh, just, you know, the local people are doing it. They're often talking about hundreds, thousands. I came across a wonderful article from the Empire. Was written in 1855, and it describes how between 1842 and 1844 there was a movement that they said almost went from what's now Melbourne all the way up to Wide Bay, and in that whole area there was sort of like an uprising, and they were wondering how that was coordinated, and the fellows were actually speculating, well, maybe word of mouth, so on, so on. But the particular example I was looking at was around what's now southeast Queensland, and the that there were some 14, 15 groups that actually worked together to mount a campaign that was fairly successful. And this is the other thing I found. I'm thinking it probably was the same in other parts of Australia too. They actually evicted white people from what's now Wide Bay and from a good part of the Downs for, you know, it varied, but I mean, there were some of us that went like on the Wide Bay, it was like for 4 years, you know, it's quite a length of time.
Okay, tell us, you know that in Jeff's chapter on the war on the grasslands, he did concede there was some evidence of tribal cooperation, but not enough.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, there's been a sort of a bias in academia about that, oh, you know, it was just the local group, you know, and that's become sort of almost a dogma. I don't think the sources show that, you know. They, I mean, it is difficult sometimes to unravel where, you know, where groups start and end. But even a lot of the Indigenous communities themselves, they have a regional perspective. They, you know, the people from Tasmania tend to talk about themselves as the Palawa. Up here, it's the Guri, and it's Kuri down in just a bit south of the border, and Murray a bit further west. And these seem to be distinctive regions of people that had a shared identity, often through large gatherings like the Bunya Festival and so on. And they were able to cooperate. The same thing happened in North America. They could, on some level, cooperate.
This is Ellen Nell on RN, and my guest is Ray Kirkhove. Okay, let me quote Blaney. One of the problems in Queensland is that there is no unity amongst Aborigines, and a sizable portion Some say one third of the deaths of Aborigines in the fighting and the skirmishes were caused by the mounted police, who, of course, were overwhelmingly Aboriginal people.
And that's an interesting, you know, and I know he then goes on to use that as a, you know, well, you know, how is this possible? Jonathan Richards, who's written a lot on this, and he points out that, well, a lot of these people were coerced into being part of the native police. It wasn't just like they said, oh, come and join us, boys. They actually went around and basically forced people in a lot of cases. There was a huge level of people deserting. And then there was also massive cruelty, and almost like a tyranny of the white officers over the little troops. So it's a little bit, I don't know if that's the full picture. But the other thing is, too, you have to think of, you know, and I've known it's used, oh, well, look, they saw the other tribe as a completely foreign group to some degree, but often they went and joined them. And even when they didn't, you have to bear in mind that strange things happen in wars. You know, my own family, they come from Holland, and I know that in my own family there was one part that joined the underground. There was another part that was wiped out in Germany for being Jewish, and there was still another part that joined the Nazis. Now,
yeah. How
do you account for that? Well, people go with whatever they think wins, or they go...
And, of course, even within the death camps, there were Jews that were coerced into working with the Nazis against their own people.
Yeah, and I think the native police is a very interesting phenomenon. It was happening, there were similar sort of things all over the world. You know, there were scouts, there were Indian scouts, there was in South Africa they had a similar thing. And it was sort of like you thought you were on the winning side, you know? You know, you thought this was the future. People brainwashed themselves into things, you know? And it was sort of a way of getting a little bit of status in a society that was crumbling.
This is Ellie Nell on RN and all sorts of other platforms, and we're discussing Indigenous warfare in colonial Australia with Dr. Ray Kirkhove, who's a professional historian, researcher and writer. One of the issues of fighting between tribes, Ray, that I put to Geoffrey Blaney, some of your research, quoting Leichhardt, that fighting often involved little killing.
Yeah.
Now, Jeff wasn't too impressed with Leichhardt as a trusted source. Any other evidence?
Oh, well, a huge amount, actually. You know, the interesting thing is that these accounts of, you know, like, oh, you know, oh, well, they slaughtered a whole lot of people and this sort of thing, that usually comes from third-hand sort of evidence. And when I've read into this, what I've found is that it's usually... you know, just like after a good football match, everyone goes and says, oh, we absolutely killed them, you know. And this is the sort of boastfulness that used to happen among Aboriginal people, you know, like in their tournaments. But the actual eyewitnesses, and they're much fewer, their accounts always state, well, it was a lot of jumping around, but hardly anyone, it was rare that anyone got hurt, let alone killed. A good example is William Clark, who observed a lot of this he said that as soon as there was blood, then the cry went out, Belmore, Belmore, and everyone just stopped because that meant that side had won. Petrie gives a very long account of how the tournaments were conducted. They were very formal. They involved hundreds of people, almost thousands. So if there's, say, one person injured or lost, that's a pretty remarkable result compared to the kind of wars white people were conducting. So I think it's still, you know, their wars were not as ferocious.
There's some debate among historians looking at Indigenous warfare about the impact of individual Aboriginal leaders.
Yes.
Windchuddle is interesting on this. Well, I use the word interesting problematically, but talk to that about individual leaders. It was that issue that had you and I talking all those years ago.
Yes, yeah. Dennis Foley's done some work on this too, and he often says, oh, it's sort of uncharacteristic to have a single leader because Aboriginal leadership is plural. And when I looked into that, yeah, I think that I'd have to agree too. But I think we tend to look at sort of North American Indian examples, and that's not a fair, I mean, it's a different culture here. People were much more reticent, and a powerful leader in Indigenous society was a fairly quiet person who did their who didn't always give away what, you know, didn't play all their cards, didn't tell you what they were up to, and particularly never would tell an opponent what they were up to. So this is why you get such strange court cases where Aboriginal people would just say anything because they didn't see any. You know, why would they tell a white administrator who was going to hang them what they were really up to or why they did this and that? You know, they just sort of just said any heap of nonsense. And I think a lot of them were sort of loner leaders, from what I've been able to work out. And some of the models were often like you've heard of the clever person, the clever man, but that's also in a lot of the Dreamtime stories. Is this a person who sort of outwits people? And I think that is a big part of the kind of leadership that was offered.
Tell us about, is it Dundali or Dundali?
Dundali, yeah.
Yeah, who was publicly executed in Brisbane in 1855. He's still regarded as controversial.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good example. You know, I mean, I've worked quite a bit with Libby Connors, who's actually putting out a biography, she's hoping soon, on Dundali, and also with people who are, you know, related to or have information on it. You know, a lot of Aboriginal people I know. And again, yeah, it's a funny thing because often they seem to be like almost an outlaw character, and the difficulty is in Australia, of course. A black leader is technically an outlaw, you know, because he's not going along with the government. So it does make it a very fuzzy area, and there have been different people trying to present Dundali as just, oh, he's just a murderer. But then you have to look at, well, what's motivating? What are they actually doing? And that, again, I think needs a lot more work, and I've been trying to get a little handle on that because there's often not a lot of statements that have been left to us. So we're always guessing. We're thinking, oh, well, he did this because of that. He did this because of this. But we do have statements from Aboriginal people saying that they perceived these people as their leaders and that they were following them, and often they were working in with a whole lot of other people, but it's just that often we don't have all the details that we have, like in the US, where at least the Americans were prepared to sort of sit down and take down the full stories of their opponents.
I'm sorry to turn myself off. You say that when discussing Indigenous warfare here, it's often compared to tribal resistance against settlement in other countries, Native Americans, as you say, or closer to home, the Maori Wars in New Zealand.
Yeah, yeah, and people say, oh, the casualties weren't as great and so on. And I think, well, yes, but isn't that a great thing, you know? Indigenous resistance, the more I've looked at it, it was a lot of economic sabotage, but it was brilliantly done. You know, to have, to slaughter, you know, 1,000 head of cattle there and several hundred here and go run to run and do this and basically starve out the settlers was an act of genius in a way, because it's sort of like, well, it's hard then to go and say, oh, well, okay, therefore we're justified in killing them, you know. So they were kind of working a way that would really just heavily frustrate the settlers without inflaming them to the point of them all getting slaughtered, you know.
Are you in fact describing guerrilla conflict, guerrilla war?
I think so. That's been a big. There's people like Dennis Gray who've sort of said, well, I don't know if it's even guerrilla warfare, because it is a different sort of guerrilla warfare. It's not the same sort of thing as was. It's certainly not like 1970s, you know, Khmer Rouge or something. It's quite a different nature. A lot of it was continual harassment. There's a number of stories about how they would just come in and just continually take all the crops, or they would just continually walk into houses and just take everything. And they did this almost daily sometimes, you know. So it wasn't just to get food, and often the like I said, for the cattle, they were just slaughtered in such vast quantities and just left on the field. But it has that effect. It was a form of like terrorism.
Just in the moments we've got left together, let's go back to a controversial battle between several tribes and settlers that occurred near Toowoomba in 1843, called the Battle of One Tree Hill. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm doing work currently with some of the descendants of Neville Bonner and some of the other families out there. And that's a classic, you know. That was a defeat. White people were defeated. For those who don't know the story, they basically ambushed first they actually fenced up a road and then ambushed a dray. It was actually three drays out of a set of about 10. And the armed men of the drays, there were about 18 of them, they all ran off, but they came back for reinforcements, and then Multagra, who was one of the leaders, went up a hill. We're still trying to work out which one, by the way, because there's a bit of controversy over
God,
that.
You're hopeless, you bloody historians. You can't even find the hill.
Well, I tell you what, you know, the problem is people tell tall tales and then you've got to unravel all their memories. You know, it's not an easy thing. Anyway, we're still tossing up whether it's Sugarloaf, which is Mount Davidson, or what's now Mount Tabletop. But I in either case, they ran up a hill and as in a mock retreat and hurled boulders and things down and injured quite a lot of the forces, and those whites actually had to retreat and then had to chase them for another 3 weeks, and it went on and on like this. That was just the start. It just went on for like a decade, you know, of these little skirmishes and so on, continual harassment. But particularly I'm trying to map that out, because that hasn't been done, you know, and that's I think why there's often this sense of, oh look, there was no real war here, because we haven't bothered to do that fine grained stuff of working out, well, okay, where was the battle, how did, you know, you know,
well, Keith Windchuttle says unless you've got the documents, you ain't got history. And of course that's not easy to get in this area, is it, Ray? There's always a problem for any historian collecting evidence and testing it. But there's a special problem when you're writing about Australian Indigenous warfare.
Exactly, yeah. But surprisingly, like in this case, there seems to have been declaration of war by Aboriginal people. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence of that from Simpson and other people there were letters put to the governor on all this. And a lot of people reminisced and wrote very graphic accounts, and this is why I always find it stunning that Windchuttle actually says that never happened. And I think, well, isn't he reading what they wrote in the papers of the 1890s? They weren't very coy about what they did.
Thanks for talking to me, Ray. Dr. Ray Kirkhove, a professional historian, researcher and writer, and we're discussing his different mode of war.